Welcome to the Smart Tech Check podcast, hosted by Mark Vina, your home for candid, insightful, and provocative conversations about the smart home, home automation, security, smartphones, PC and console gaming, and much more.
Hi, everyone. My name is Mark Vina, host of the Smart Tech Check podcast. Today is Tuesday, February 18th, 2025. Joining me for today's podcast is Rob Pegoraro, who writes about tech developments at PC Mag, Fast Company, and other fine publications. John Quain, who writes for the New York Times, Smart Cities, and Tom's Guide. And a newbie on my Smart Tech Check podcast is Prakash Sagam, founder and principal analyst at the Tantra Analyst. Gentlemen, how are each of you doing?
Very good.
Good.
For a Tuesday, yeah.
Yeah. It is on Tuesday. I wish it was Friday, but it's only Tuesday. Prakash is a terrific technology analyst that I've spent some time with over the last year or so far. And we actually did some stuff at Samsung Unveiled, but my audio on my camera failed, and so I couldn't use the content. So I've invited him on my podcast. I'm glad to have him. And let me tee up the topics we want to talk about. Some of these will be. I think we'll get some very interesting feedback from each of you. I want to talk a little bit about the rise of DeepSeek. Since I last did this podcast, they were kind of like, we didn't really talk about them, but they really came out of nowhere. They were kind of like a bat out of hell. They really did a number in the early two or three days on NVIDIA because I think there was a disruption concern that, hey, if DeepSeek is successful and they can provide compelling benchmarks with lower end AI chips, and they have an open model approach, they were really in a position to kind of disrupt the marketplace. And so NVIDIA has recovered quite a bit. There's obviously, I think there's a lot of concerns in the minds of analysts in terms of, are US companies really going to embrace DeepSeek because of privacy concerns that a lot of companies have with Chinese based firms. But let me just get Prakash, since you're a newbie to the podcast, let me get your opinion on what's your take on DeepSeek. What are your concerns? I did see some information this morning that a lot of the benchmarking seems to be bearing out that DeepSeek does have they have something to talk about from a value proposition standpoint, which is kind of interesting. It's not just all smoke and mirrors, but let me get your initial impressions.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an interesting development. I mean, we have seen it. Interesting is an understatement. I think an important aspect is basically, you know, it is proving that you don't need, you know, thousands and thousands of these GPUs for a reasonable model. And also it kind of helps. I mean, I've been tweeting about it, moving the AI towards the edge and kind of democratizing it. You could have a teacher model in the cloud, student model on the devices, and kind of a collaborative distributed AI. It's a great, in my view, if nothing else, it's a great step in that direction. I think other AI folks have talked about as well, this distillation model. They will probably adopt themselves as well. Of course, there is, you know, the cloud-based model still be predominant for foreseeable future, and that has its value, but it's kind of giving a variety, a twist, and a little bit democratization of AI at a very high level. Security concerns, I mean, anything that comes of China, they'll always have security concerns. But if it is a model that is running on-prem, you know, independent, not even connecting the internet, maybe some of those could be solved where I think the value lies for DeepSeek.
John, what's your take on DeepSeek? Because we haven't talked about that since we did our last podcast. Yeah.
That's right. You know, it's a little old school, the model. You know, they made it open source so you could see what they basically did. And back in the Deep Blue days, you know, trying to beat chess players and stuff like that from IBM. You know, the people behind those AI programs always said doing something like generative AI, where you're trying to use that, you know, massive neural network to understand everything, was never going to work. Mm-hmm. And kind of why they said that would never work is because what you're seeing now is, I need infinite computing resources, and it's asymptotic, right? I'm kind of getting better. I'm getting a little bit better. I'm not quite getting the answer. I'm still not quite, but I'm getting a little closer. It's not going to really get there. But using that as just described, you know, these separate expert systems and then coordinating that, that's a much more workable model. You don't need the computing power. There's always something wrong. If I've got to build data centers like I've never had to build before, something's wrong with my model when I can beat it, you know, any day of the week. So that seems like, something's wrong. And they just kind of showed that. I think you're going to see people resetting and launching different projects to see if they can make this model work, and it's available to them to look at. So why not? And then you won't have everybody sort of chasing after the same gold ring, which they kind of are doing right now.
Well, I think the point you just made about the power efficiency piece, which probably should get talked about a lot more, that in a pre-DeepSeek world, with NVIDIA's data centers, I mean, the megawatt power requirements are massive. And by the way, not available in many locations around the world. There's only certain locations where they can generate that much power. So the power efficiency piece is obviously a big deal. But I always like to talk to Rob and hand him the controversial aspects. And this Rob is such a great guy at responding to stuff like that. Let's talk about the China security and privacy stuff that, you know, it haunts China. And, you know, I think that's an understatement probably when I say that. Do you see major corporations embracing DeepSeek or refusing to it, even though they recognize the value proposition is really good, frankly? And there is a democratization of AI that DeepSeek is driving. But do you see a lot of companies saying, well, you know, maybe we're better off going with a higher, even though the cost may be higher for a traditional NVIDIA data center type of solution versus, you know, some of the risks that, you know, people are concerned about when dealing with a Chinese company? Rob?
So, yeah, that's the two sides of DeepSeek. One is the app you can install on your phone. I've not done that. Or the chatbot you can run in a web browser. I've done that in an incognito window, where it's really interesting talking to that version of DeepSeek. It does something I've never seen a chatbot do before, which is start answering a question. In my case, I asked, what interesting things happened in 1989 around the world? And it gets two paragraphs in and then erases the whole thing and says, let's talk about something else.
That's a big deal. By the way, that's a big deal.
It's uncanny. You click up with the screen grab, you can get these things. Another one I asked is Xinhua News Agency a trustworthy news source? And it was writing a very lengthy answer saying, you know, their concerns about it channeling Chinese Communist Party propaganda, and then erase the whole thing. It's like the little man inside the data center is backspacing frantically. But then there's the one you can run it on your own computer. I run it on this Mac Mini using an app called LM Studio. You can run a non-China-based version of it on other AI platforms. I think it's an option in Microsoft subscription. And that's entirely different. And I could certainly see U.S. companies doing that because it's not running untrustworthy code on a data center somewhere on the other side of Beijing. This is something being done on-prem or in a U.S. cloud. And that apparently is doing the work of AI much more efficiently, which, as I was naive before, is a big deal. I'm coming to you from near the data center capital of the world, Northern Virginia. And our state legislature, they did a study that came out in December that said at current rates, unconstrained growth, electricity consumption here will double over the next 10 years just from data centers. And that's not going to work. We can't build enough power plants, and Virginia voters are not going to accept their electricity bills going through the roof because of some Meta or Google chatbot that is making up stuff on their phones. That's just not going to work.
So, Prakash, before we close this one out, because we could talk about DeepSeek forever, what do you, you know, you follow NVIDIA as well. You know, do you think that it's going to dramatically change NVIDIA's strategy? I mean, it could certainly have an effect in terms of collapsing the price premium that they get. That would be an obvious one. But, you know, just knowing NVIDIA the way you do, do you think that you think this is just a bump in the road, or do you think that it will have a pretty profound impact since NVIDIA has like 90% of the data center market? I mean, that's a pretty significant situation.
I mean, obviously there will be knee-jerk reaction that we have seen, But I think we are at a very early stage of AI. The growth potential is pretty high. So I think at the end of the day, that happens in any technology, there'll be multiple versions of the technology, right? Benefiting different parts of the world. It will not be end of the road for NVIDIA, of course. It will have to temper the growth that that everything will run on NVIDIA and these expensive H100s and thousands of them. If you want to be a AI player, if you want to use AI, you have to have a, you know, thousands of stacks of these. I think that is kind of a, you know, that is not obviously realistic, as we've been talking about. And that is proven true as well. But I think there'll still be a huge opportunity for NVIDIA in AI, sure.
Mm-hmm. But I wonder,
other versions and other options as well.
You know, I wonder, and Rob said to me something that was, it said something that was very interesting in terms of the way it kind of deletes information after spurting out an answer.
Yeah, there are tons of, I mean, I come from India, so anything that's coming from China, when I check related to India and China relations, I mean, obviously it is trained on those data sets, and it and that is intentional, so you can see those. You know, that's true with many things coming from the US as well, to some extent, right? It's like,
yeah,
Google named this Gulf of America, right? So there will always be those, influences. But when you're doing enterprise workload, not related to politics, then I think none of these things matters, right? Nothing matters unless the data is being sent somewhere else, which is unreliable, right? So,
well, Prakash, I'm going to test it later, because I'm going to ask it, how did the New York Giants perform last season?
Yeah. And I probably, that is unreliable. It would work, right? I mean, if you talk about Chinese government and anything, then you might have different answers. And also this, I think I'm more impressed by this notion of distilling models with teacher and student. That architecture, I think, is proven, and a lot of people have said it. It makes sense. I see that as an important step in the AI evolution versus DeepSeek as a company, right? So I think that has more importance than the company itself, in my view.
John, any closing thoughts on this before we move on?
No, but I do think it, I don't think you asked about NVIDIA. I don't think it's going to have an impact immediately on that, but I would be revising downward, you know, that long-term horizon, number of chips sold, because there will be different approaches. I think this is just an indication also that there are several different approaches to take to AI that are running right now, that haven't really come out in public, that could. And then there will be something that we're not foreseeing that will use a different kind of processor. It just so happens that we use image recognition kind of algorithm to start this. And so that just fell into NVIDIA's lap. Dumb luck. It was not planned. It was nothing. So same thing could happen, because we're going to talk about a different company soon. And that could change pretty rapidly. Within a couple of years, we could see things swing the other way. But so it's just an indication, hey, there's a lot more potential out there. There's a lot more that can be done.
I think that's fair. I think it would be an overreaction to say it's going to, you know, have a tremendous impact on NVIDIA. Now, it may, what will be interesting over the next few quarters is to look at the margin line at NVIDIA, is that even if they're growing their revenue and it doesn't really impact, DeepSeek doesn't impact them from a revenue growth standpoint, it could affect them from a margin standpoint if they decide to get more aggressive on pricing. But we'll see if that happens. But let's talk about the next company that John hinted at, and that is Intel. They had their earnings not too long ago. And, you know, it was, I mean, the thing that I'm trying to wrap my head around, since Pat Gelsinger left the company, I think what a lot of analysts are looking at is, have they turned things around? And you really can't tell, you know, after a single earnings announcement, after they let go, or they, or the CEO, Pat Gelsinger, you know, retired, air quotes. The thing is that what I've struggled with and I want to get you, Prakash's opinion on this. What I've struggled with at Intel is that, and I know this is going to sound like a bit of a cheap shot, but I feel like the company still believes it's like it's the late 90s. And the whole foundryless model has proven to be a very effective model, whether you're Qualcomm, whether you're AMD. It took AMD a while to get to where they need to be, and I think that's a testament to Lisa Su. But there's other companies that have thrived in this foundryless model, Apple being another good example. The only compelling reason why I see Intel wanting to make the foundry model worse is the national security implication issues. I mean, do we really want chips that will show up in defense systems like F-16s and things like that, with chips that are not being manufactured by an American company? Now, just recently, you've got TSMC and Broadcom announced some interest in maybe, you know, carving up the foundry group and buying parts of it. And Intel stock has actually actually benefited from that. But Prakash, let me get your view on the whole foundry thing, because I just don't, you know, that to me is the big deal. I think they've made some intelligent choices in terms of bets on AI platforms that they want to continue to invest in, and some platforms they've decided to put like in mothballs for a while. But just in the foundry topic, what's your view?
I mean, foundry is an important asset for them. The issue with foundry has been in terms of delivery, right? So I agree with you. Maybe let's be changed in terms of mindset. They said, you know, whatever they decided the boundary, the foundry fab roadmap, and say, you know, market follows us. If we are delayed by 2 years, many of the nodes case, you know, it's okay, right? The whole market will be delayed. But that has changed, right? And I think now, not now, but a few years ago, they realized that. So their model with their own fab has worked in the past. I'm not so sure they are ready if they break the design part with the fab part, whether a design part can stand on its own, be profitable and compete with Qualcomm's, Apple's, ARM's, and everybody else in the world, because they have never been in that except for this Lunar Lake and some of the Arrow Lake, right? So unless we see that is a successful project, both of these, at least the Lunar Lake and the Panther Lake, then you can get some confidence that as an independent design-only company, fabless company, whether that group can sustain. I'm not yet sure on it because they've been late so far, right? And the foundry business, it is not just Intel's problem, right? As you pointed out, it is more of a national security problem. So when you have this combined company, you know, there is confusion on what is the focus, to make Intel profitable or to make the country reliable, you know, has its own reliable source of chips, right? So, and what problem you're solving as an executive of the company, you are torn between the two. So breaking them might make sense, but breaking them will probably keep the foundry because of all the government incentives and with nationalistic government, administration, they can put pressure on large US companies to utilize Intel's foundry, for example. I mean, theoretically, if it is broken away, I think the design-only fabless part, I'm not yet sure that it will stand on its own and be very complete. Yeah. They have to basically slim it very very severely, and they have to be very nimble and agile to adapt to the changes. They can't operate the way they are doing now. So that's at a very high level. And it is one thing. There's so many rumors. It's very hard to analyze any of this because every day, I think there was another rumor today, somebody else joining the group. It was Elon Musk in the beginning. It was Qualcomm before that. And then Broadcom joining the party. I think Global Foundries also was mentioned or something like that. So, you know, it's very hard how it will turn out. But I think the problem should be, there are two problems that they are solving. It's not one problem. Then, you know, they have to realize that and maybe come up with strategies for two separate strategies for those two separate problems, in my view.
Yeah. So Rob, you know, Prakash brings up a very important point, is that, you know, even if you decide to spin things off, which, you know, is certainly under discussion right now, the question really is can the design portion of their business stand alone? You know, I mean, obviously becomes a smaller entity if all of a sudden it's just a design entity. And the and again, this is the thorny issue. When the rationalization beyond the national security topics we've talked about has always been from a foundry standpoint. If I'm Intel, well, if we can't fill up the fabs, Gritstein fabs, obviously, if you're not running over 100%, it's hard to make money, frankly. So if they're not, so what we'll do is we'll farm some of our capacity out to other companies. Now, the challenge is that Apple, for example, which does big volumes, it's hard for me to see Apple doing business with Intel foundry business because, yes, there's supposed to be a separation between church and state, between the design and the production side, but that could be a problem. You know, I mean, I know Intel would say that would never happen, but you know, the flip side is that Intel would always tout, hey, when you buy an Intel, we're better at bringing processors to market because we have a foundry business, because designing a chip and getting into a manufacturing process configuration is two very different disciplines. So Rob, what's your perspective?
Well, from a national security perspective, I got to bring that in, sitting like 3 miles from the Capitol. where else are you going to have a chip foundry? If it's in Taiwan, that is not a long-term risk-free place. I hope it stays risk-free, but the Republic of China has its own concept of Taiwan's role in the world, and it is not as an independent, existing separate country. Mm-hmm. Certainly, and yeah, the U.S. government decided with the Chips and Science Act that it was in our national interest to have more chip foundries in the U.S., and I know Trump had said some mean things about that. I do not think he has tried to get rid of it. He has not said DOGE, which I have to point out is not an actual department, on the Chips and Science Act. And the MIT actually had the story about the administration is trying to sort of put together the sort of deal between Intel and TSMC that would have Intel hand over some of its foundries to TSMC, which is, there's been a lot to keep up in my neighborhood in terms of tech policy in the last 2 weeks, so I may have missed some other plot twists.
But
there are separate issues. How does Intel as a company do? What is its role going forward? And then we as a country, where are we going to make sure that these, very high performance processors, where are they getting designed? Where are they getting built? Is it someplace that we can be pretty sure is not going to be subject to supply chain or other interruptions?
John, your perspective.
I keep the Global Foundry as well, and it's a trusted chip manufacturer. Not sure that's probably a wise move. Not sure that probably needs to be looked at again. But the current administration, they have interests that are over there, so maybe it'll continue to be a trusted partner. I'm a guy who still has CDs, so I like to have stuff, right? I like to have software. And I still like the hardware. And I remember when Intel started this whole campaign way back when, it's got to be 25 years ago, they wanted to be a fabless company. They were like, you know what? There's no profit in this making the chips anymore. And they started to make those moves. And I thought, yeah, there's a lot. So I still think there is a way to leverage it, mostly in innovation, not so much in profit margins, but in terms of new technologies and new ways to make chips, and you can't farm that out. And that is something where if they can innovate, then they can make some headway. But if they're just talking about making chips the old lithography way, then yeah, it doesn't, from a profit standpoint, it doesn't make a lot of sense. But if somebody gets in there in charge now and says, no, this is what we're going to do, and we're going to decidedly try to innovate, then that would be a good thing to do. The national security issues with Rob, I have no idea now what it's all free for all, who knows what could happen.
The variable here is that you don't really hear a lot out of DOGE or Trump yet on this topic. And, it is going to come to a head at some point. And at that point, Rob will put his house up for sale and move to Montana. Probably that would be my.
They're going to ban vaccines there. Although I love the scenery, Glacier National Park. It's beautiful. See it while the glaciers are still around.
Well, let's get to our last topic here. We've got a few minutes left here. Samsung had their big Unpacked 2025 event a couple of weeks ago, they announced their new phones. They're really going down a very much a personalized AI path. I mean, I think they're doing what a lot of other companies are trying to do, including LG on the, believe it or not, on the home appliance side. They're trying to make AI a bit more warm and fuzzy, you know, a bit less threatening, certainly more customized. They have a whole strategy around AI at the edge and information that you trust with your device doesn't go up to the cloud. And again, Prakash, we were talking about this at the event itself, that it doesn't seem that the hardware was almost like second in consideration. You know, I mean, we're past the days where, you know, you go to these events where it's an Apple event. Apple's supposedly going to announce a new SE tomorrow, so we don't know about that quite yet. We'll see what happens with that. But at the Unpacked event, the hardware seemed almost seemed to be playing second fiddle, you know. So, Prakash, what was your kind of the key takeaways at the Unpacked event? What's your thoughts?
Yeah, I agree with you, man. As we saw, right, it was Galaxy AI event. It was not S25 event, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they had few slides on the gaming and the other specs and so on, but it was all about AI. Even the hardware providers like Qualcomm, which provides the SoC for S25, their customized Snapdragon 8 Elite, they say that it is like an AI powerhouse, right? So, and I actually did the review. I've been using the phone for a few days. I mean, the talk of AI in the phone started last year, right? Even in the S24, it was also a Galaxy AI event, and they talk about AI. At that point of time, it was just hype and talk. There was nothing usable at all other than, you know, a few gimmicky things like, you know, take a picture and your persona and so on things. But now I see some green shoots of what AI could be used for on the phones on the usability side.
Mm-hmm.
There are a few things, the briefs and other things, more of, you know, personalizing and automating a few of the routine things you don't want to do, right? So there are some of that. I think there are more utilitarian AI applications in the phone, use cases in the phone with S25 now than before. But is that an absolute essential when somebody is buying a phone right now? Maybe not. If it is there, you can use it. But that's not a decision maker for a new phone. But the problem is, if you want to buy a top-tier phone right now, you know, you have to buy a phone with AI, need it or not. So I think my feeling on it is just like how happened with 5G. There will be penetration of these phones by default, because if you want to buy a flagship phone, it has AI in it. And then the use cases and developments will kind of bubble up once you have enough volume of these things. And I'm sure there'll be somebody who come up with interesting way of using them. I mean, and we see some green shoots of that usability in this phone is my point.
Now, John, you know, Prakash said something interesting. The second interesting thing he said during the podcast, everything you say, Prakash, is interesting. But the one thing that jumped out at me was that so far AI, whether it's regardless of the brand, and I would even go back to Apple, it seems to be very niche-y. There's some interesting things from a usage model standpoint. For example, Samsung showed off, which I was really impressed with because I do a lot of video-related work, the ability to isolate audio. There was a great demo they showed where two or three people were at a diner, and the two people were groups of two people were sitting next to each other, and using AI, they're able to isolate the audio to the two people that you want to accentuate the audio. That to me is interesting. Now, be honest with you, is that a mainstream feature? Probably not, honestly, but I guess the question for you, John, is that are we kind of, if AI is going to manifest itself, is it really inherently a kind of niche-y thing? And there really isn't a breakthrough usage model that appeals to 90% of the population? Or
there isn't, I mean, there isn't a breakthrough, you know, I think there are green shoots too. I see them as well coming up. So I agree that there are these possibilities that we see, I keep coming back to imaging because one of the things they did too was the search through your photos thing, which that's really helpful because of these devices. Now we just have thousands of photos and we take them from everything from, you know, the password on somebody's Wi-Fi router that I'm fixing or the serial number. I take a picture of it. So I've got it when tech support 3 hours later calls me. But then I've taken 20 pictures in the interim. Where is that photo? But that's the original point of these algorithms, right? I remember IBM, again, like more than 20 years ago, trying to find pictures that had grass in them. That was the challenge. It was like this impossible thing to do because there's green carpet and there's AstroTurf and there's like, so actually doing that. So this is actually, that could help actually go through all those photos. Find the ones, one of me shoveling snow yesterday in Vermont. How's that? You know, even if it's just that, I would be happy with that. And I agree. It's very niche-y. Finding those particular niches where it works really well in those special cases, because it clearly doesn't work in search engines, right? That's just not happening right now. And it doesn't help in composing essays, and it doesn't help. All those things are very flawed and, wrong or hallucinate, however you want to say. But I think there are those green shoots definitely there. And I also agree, you're not going to be able to buy a phone without, which is kind of like, And your point too, you said, well, there's not really an upgrade. That's right. Most of the screens were the same. So the hardware was basically the same. Oh, it's 40% faster with an AI algorithm. That was about it. It's like, Well, I want a sharper screen. I want an indestructible phone that I can like stomp on. You know, that's what I want anyway. So I agree with you guys exactly the way you characterized it.
Rob, in the couple of minutes we have left in the podcast, you know what's interesting to me is that, when Apple does it, it will force the conversation. You know, Apple obviously, Samsung obviously has been all over foldable displays. Even the newer models are much more robust than the original versions from 3 or 4 years ago. Apple hasn't done a single thing with a foldable design. There's all kinds of rumors all over the place. Doubtful that they'll do anything this year, from a supply chain standpoint. But is that the inflection point? You know, meaning that, once Apple does something and they legitimize something, and they'll find an interesting way you would use some type of foldable display.
It hasn't really worked out with the virtual reality though, has it?
No, that's true. Thank you for being honest here on that.
I don't know. I'm thinking about how do I use AI on my Pixel 9 phone or the Mac Mini in front of me, and the answer is not much. The Apple Intelligence feature I use most often is the one in Mail that has a little summary of what is the message about, and that is only because AI can tell me what it is when the sender can't be bothered to put any kind of subject line in it. That's actually useful. Most of this other stuff is not super practical. There are limited uses where it's nice. A lot of it, being able to search through a large library of images, even though they're not labeled, Google Photos has had that for a while. So I don't know. The other thing to watch for, of course, we started out talking about here's Samsung's new hardware, which is, nice, but not breakthrough. And here's a new software. At what point do these new AI features get backported to the M4 or an older line? Because how much difference in processing horsepower is there between this year's model and last year's model?
Mm-hmm. Right. No, I agree. And let's face it, the smartphone companies, the Apples, the Samsungs, they want to sell hardware. As much as they like to, they're embracing AI in a big way. And it's, the rise of AI in many ways is going to blur the need for that upgrade that, gone are the days from 5 to 7 years ago where Apple or Samsung would come out with new hardware that you had to get the newest phone, for whatever reason, if it was faster, more storage, larger, in the case of the Max models that Apple introduced. And of course, Samsung's always been around that, but I don't know. I mean, I just think that, I'm actually waiting for my S25 from the good old folks at Samsung, because I've been an Apple guy my entire life. And I was so impressed with the hardware. It's a good looking phone. I'm wondering if this is going to be the first non-Apple phone that will persuade me to leave the Apple ecosystem, and for me to make that statement, for those people who know who, you know, because I've been kind of an Apple guy my whole life. And by the way, I would love to move on, you know, from Apple for a whole bunch of different reasons, mostly cost.
Hey, Mark, the title of my review was, you buy it, S25 Ultra I reviewed, buy it for the performance and keep it for Galaxy AI. So you buy it for the performance right now. And since, there is a lot of AI horsepower on the phone, there will be uses in the future. And also, a lot of the things that we are seeing on the phone right now in terms of AI, we're kind of moving what we had in cloud, moving to the phone. Like, for example, searching of, unlabeled pictures on Google Photos was there years before, right? The only thing is now, earlier you had to put all of your photos on Google Photos on the cloud for it to check it out. You may or may not want to put all the photos there, right?
Right.
Now, all of that coming to devices. So the current phase is more of bringing the cloud AI useful features onto the device. But that's only evolution. I think the real use will be when you have use cases designed for this device using AI. I think we have not seen a lot of them yet. That's where I think things get interesting, in my view.
No, I think you're absolutely right, Prakash. But let's wrap it up there. And guys, again, thanks for participating in today's podcast. For our viewing and listening audience, thanks for making the Smart Tech Check podcast part of your day or commute. Please make sure that you hit the like and subscribe buttons at the end of today's podcast or use these on-screen QR codes to connect with me. You can also follow me on X at Mark Vina Tech Guy. And until next time, have a great week. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.